The educated classes might sneer because of an aversion towards all sentiments and practices associated with religion, and also perhaps because they were reluctant to acknowledge the existence of these somewhat alarming sentiments within themselves. But the fact remained that the coronation provided at one time and for practically the entire society such an intensive contact with the sacred that we believe we are justified in interpreting it as a great act of national communion.
Oil and oaths, orbs, scepters, symbol upon symbol,
declares the Duke of Windsor at the end of Smoke and Mirrors in Peter Morgan's version of this anthropological discussion.
It's an unfathomable web of arcane mystery and liturgy, blurring so many lines, no clergyman, historian, or lawyer could ever untangle any of it.
It's crazy,
agrees one of his American friends, who has been watching the televised service, to be politely contradicted by his host.
On the contrary, says the Duke, it's perfectly sane. Who wants transparency when you can have magic? Who wants prose when you can have poetry? Pull away the veil, and what are you left with? An ordinary young woman of modest ability and little imagination. But wrap her up like this, anoint her with oil, and hey presto, what do you have? A goddess.
His friend reflects pensively.
And to think you turned all that down, the chance to be a god.
Once again, the Duke contradicts him.
I turned it down, he says, for something greater still,
turning fondly to look at his wife.
For love,
smiles the former Mrs. Simpson. It makes for a powerful conclusion, with the Duke of Windsor shrewdly skewering the complex and deceptive myth of what adds up to royalness. Equally complex and deceptive, of course, is the myth of what adds up to love. King Edward VIII reigned the 20th of January to the 11th of December, 1936. Officially, Edward, Prince of Wales, but known to his family as David, Duke of Windsor, 1936 to 1972. 1894 to 1972. Played by Alex Jennings. The Prince of Wales, one feels, would not raise his finger to save his future sceptre, wrote the diarist Henry Chips Channon as early as 1925. In fact, many of his intimate friends think he will be only too happy to renounce it. As the abdication crisis of 1936 drew ever closer, it is remarkable how many other observers talked of David seeking some pretext to shake off his royal destiny, as if the scenario of romance and renunciation was just a means to an end. If Wallace Simpson had not existed, we must ask ourselves, would the reluctant king have had to invent her? The Crown delivers an open verdict. The drama records how duty was observed and delivered by Edward VIII's successors, George VI and Queen Elizabeth II. But there remains the challenge posed by the ex-king across the water. To what higher purpose should we dedicate ourselves, if not to a loved one, and to the eternal cause of love? Wallace Warfield Simpson, Duchess of Windsor, 1896 to 1986, played by Leah Williams. Hark the herald angels sing, Mrs. Simpson's Pinched Our King, ran a doggerel Christmas carol in 1936. Whether people laughed about her or not, the popular verdict on Wallis Simpson was virtually unanimous. She was an evil temptress, a Lady Macbeth, and even worse, an American. But her fellow American, Chips Channon, found Wallis quite the opposite when he met her in January 1935.
A nice, quiet, well-bred mouse of a woman, he wrote, with large, startled eyes and a huge mole on her chin.
No one, wrote Winston Churchill, has been more victimized by gossip and scandal.
On the 3rd of December 1936, when Stanley Baldwin was still desperate for Edward VIII to keep the crown, Wallace retired to France to remove myself from the king's life, offering to withdraw
and indeed to do anything to prevent the king from abdicating. Cynics said she wanted David to take all the blame for what came next, and certainly the couple's life in exile proved far from idyllic. But is it possible the lady had really meant what she said? The Most Reverend Geoffrey Fisher, Archbishop of Canterbury, 1887 to 1972, played by Ronald Pickup. Cantuar, from the Latin for Canterbury, is a title by which the Archbishop of Canterbury signs his name, and it inspired a sneering poem after one of Geoffrey Fisher's predecessors, Cosmo Gordon Lang, had declared that King Edward VIII and his social circle should stand rebuked by the judgment of the nation. "My Lord Archbishop, what a scold you are, and when your man is down, how bold you are. Of charity, how oddly scant you are. Old lang swine, how full of cant you are." In episode 5 of The Crown, Peter Morgan gives the Duke of Windsor the chance to spit these lines back in the face of Geoffrey Fisher, the cantuar of the day, who presided over Elizabeth II's coronation with dignity, but shared his predecessor's gift for insensitive pronouncements. Asked if he was worried about the recently developed H-bomb, Fisher replied, "The very worst the bomb can do is to sweep a vast number of people from this world into the next, into which they must all go anyway." Cecil Beaton, photographer and diarist. If in the coronation summer of 1937 you had asked which photographer might possibly be selected to shoot the official royal portraits at the next coronation, the camp and often waspish Cecil Beaton would have been the very last name on the list. At the time, Beaton was notorious in royal circles for his flattering photographs and sketches of his friend Mrs. Ernest Simpson. He called them his Wallace collection, culminating in his alluring set of pictures of the new Duke and Duchess of Windsor to mark their wedding at the Chateau de Condé in June 1937. The social-climbing snapper was the visual propagandist for the King's party, and ultimately for the scandal of the abdication. But in the summer of 1939, on the eve of war, George VI's wife, Queen Elizabeth, one of Wallace Simpson's fiercest foes, imaginatively set enmity aside. She summoned the great glamorizer to work his magic on her, and the resulting sequence of images caused a sensation. "I wanted so much," Beaton wrote in his diary, "that these should be different from the formal, somewhat anonymous-looking photographs that had until then been taken of the royal family." And his misty, drifting images of the hitherto mousy Queen Elizabeth beside the windows of Buckingham Palace succeeded magnificently. "These pictures will be treasured in hundreds of thousands of homes throughout Britain and the Empire," enthused the Daily Sketch. "How often have you taken Mother standing by the back door of her drawing-room," asked the Daily Mirror, "to send to members of the family in distant lands?" Throughout the war years, Cecil Beaton was the photographer of choice when it came to royal images that mingled splendour with humanity. He shot some arch, Gainsborough-style poses of the young Princesses Elizabeth and Margaret Rose against the elaborate painted stage-set backdrops that he was making his trademark, along with a gritty and anything-but-sentimental portfolio of the King and Queen among the debris of the numerous German bombing raids on Buckingham Palace. Beaton himself had a good war. In 1940, in the darkest hour, he signed up with the War Artists Advisory Committee, WAAC, and served for 4 years, travelling over 100,000 miles and producing more than 30,000 war images, one of which, his moving portrait of Eileen Dunn, a wounded 3-year-old Blitz baby nursing her teddy bear in hospital, helped swing American opinion behind the British war effort. Designing haute couture and stage sets, Beaton was much more than just a photographer. In later life, his sparkling costume designs for Gigi and My Fair Lady would win him a host of awards, including 2 Academy Awards. His successful stage and movie day jobs gave his photography a memorable theatricality, so when, in 1953, royal thoughts turned to who should photograph the June coronation,
he had come to seem the obvious man for the job. But there was a complication. As he approached the age of 50, Beaton seemed to have fallen out of favour with the new regime. The young queen and her husband had commissioned Philip's friend and lunchtime companion, the raffish Stirling Henry Nahum, known professionally as Baron, to photograph their wedding and the christenings of their children, Prince Charles and Princess Anne.
"I've been wondering," Beaton confided disconsolately to his diary in May 1953, "if my day as photographer at the palace is over. Baron, a most unexpected friend of Prince Philip's, has been taking all the recent pictures."
Baron's informal style of photography chimed with the modern approach that Philip was championing for the coronation. But the new Queen Mother was firmly in the traditional camp. She disapproved of Baron, and even more of her spiky and opinionated son-in-law, about whom, according to some of Philip's friends, she retained reservations until the very end of her life. Queen Elizabeth had helped outflank Philip over the question of the family name, and now she went into action on behalf of her beloved Cecil, who had been courting her assiduously.
"I stopped at my favourite florist," he recorded in his diary early in the coronation year. "For once, I would be as extravagant as I wished. I took enormous care to choose a bouquet of all the first spring flowers to be sent to that adorable human being living in that cold, bleak palace."
The gesture was not wasted. The Queen Mother felt strongly that Beaton's history-steeped approach was right for the thousand-year heritage of the coronation, and her daughter agreed. Philip had got his way over television cameras in the Abbey, but tradition would triumph when it came to the end-of-the-day photographs for posterity that would be taken inside Buckingham Palace.
"An enormous relief," wrote Beaton when he received the news with just weeks to go.
And that very evening, by coincidence, he was invited to a ball at the American Embassy, where the Queen was guest of honour.
"No, I'm very glad you're going to take them," Elizabeth told the delighted photographer. "But by the time we get through to the photographs, we'll have circles down to here."
She pointed halfway down her cheeks.
"Then the crown comes down to here."
To the eye.
"Then the court train comes bundling up here. And I'm out to here."
Stomach sticks out.
"There are layers upon layers, skirt and mantles and trains."
The high point of his evening came when he bumped into the Queen Mother and took the opportunity to thank her for
what I am sure must have been her help in bringing about this coup for me.
The older queen said nothing, but
laughed knowingly, he recorded, launching one finger high in the air
in a gesture of triumph. Reflecting on the queen's anxiety that she would have bags under her eyes after her long morning in the Abbey, followed by an afternoon bumping round the streets of central London in the bone-shaking discomfort of the Gold State coach, Beaton started planning immediately. He wanted to make his photo session as smooth as possible for his all-important sitter, and his first order of business was the production of the two towering backdrops, Beaton called them backgrounds, that would evoke Westminster Abbey inside Buckingham Palace in a realistic but also faintly dreamlike way. The first tableau depicted the spectacular ceiling of fan-vaulted arches inside the Abbey's Lady Chapel, Elizabeth's haze of wonder again. The second derived from a Victorian engraving of the towers of the Abbey as seen from the river. The plan was for the light-framed canvases to be slid and shifted in front of each other to create different tableaus without disturbing the sitter, with the entire stage set framed by opulently patterned curtains in the corner of the palace's green drawing room. On the 1st of June, the day before the ceremony, Beaton headed for the green drawing room to set up his studio with his friend Patrick Matthews, the director of Vogue Studios, and his team of technicians and electricians. There were tripods and stepladders, mini mountains of spare fuses, film and light bulbs, and cables snaking all over the floor. It was as if, he wrote,
one might be organising a vast crowd scene for an earlier Cecil B. DeMille moving picture.
Beaton had brought flowers, roses, gladioli and clematis, from his home in Wiltshire to decorate his sets, along with his sister Barbara. Her job would be to
straighten the trains,
especially the lengthy train of the Queen herself, so long and heavy it would require the attentions of 6 fit young maids of honour selected from some of the country's grandest aristocratic families, Leicesters, Londonderrys, and Marlboroughs among them. Feeling himself superfluous as the technicians carried out their work, Beaton sneaked off down the labyrinth of palace corridors to discover a luncheon in progress for the visiting Commonwealth Prime Ministers and their wives, whose fur stoles and handbags he encountered lying on gilt chairs in the passage. Peering through a crack in the door, the photographer spied Churchill, standing and glowering with his legs apart, beside Princess Margaret with her Hanover turquoise eyes and cigarette smoke exhaling from her nostrils. As he gawked shamelessly at the high and mighty, Beaton felt like a ragamuffin bistro kid, he wrote in his diary, citing the popular advertising campaign of the time. What struck him most were the high spirits of the young queen, giggling and, quite obviously, elated at being the delightful, gay and attractive cynosure, centre of attention, of all. She wore a pale, dove fawn-coloured dress, with handbag to match. The excitement, nourished by the newspapers, mounting every day, has obviously affected her spirits, and she seemed to be in an exultant mood with a blush of triumph in her cheeks. The royal temper augured well for the morrow. Next morning, the photographer woke at 5 a.m. to get dressed in his morning suit, filling his grey top hat with his sketching implements, sandwiches, and a packet of barley sugars to keep up his strength, as one of the 8,000 guests in the abbey bidden to be in their places soon after dawn. Beaton had been allotted an observation post high in the rafters near the pipes of the great organ, so chilly on that cold June morning that he imagined himself climbing Everest alongside the Commonwealth climbers, whose achievement in reaching the summit was the talk of the morning papers.
"One has seen many woodcuts and pictures of all sorts," he wrote, looking down on the scene in stage designer mode, "of the earliest kings and queens being crowned. In all periods, painters have had a shot at recording the ceremony. Yet this spectacle today transcended all preconceived notions."
The one-time propagandist for abdication had become a sentimental royalist, and his coronation diary for June 1953 is a fascinating period piece, in which he writes as both a dazzled spectator and a knowing participant in the process.
"The ceremonial," he wrote, "seemed to be as fresh and inspiring as some great play or musical event that was being enacted upon a spontaneous impulse of genius. Perhaps it was the background of lofty vaulted stone, like a silver forest, that made everything seem so particularly surprising.
The array of colours, red, gold, and smoke blue, beguiled the photographer.
The brilliant gold carpet was the perfect floor covering for the slippered feet of the pages, the train-bearers, and the scarlet, blue, and gold-clad heralds. A mote of light caught a gold sequin fallen on the carpet, on a jewel in a bishop's ring. It was all living and new. It was history, but of today and of the future. It was something that is pulsating and vital to us, and an essential part of the life we believe in."
Looking down on the parade of visiting royalties, Beaton caught sight of the deaf and eccentric Princess Alice of Battenberg,
the mother of the Duke of Edinburgh, a contrast to the grandeur in the ash-grey draperies of a nun.
"But most dramatic and spectacular," he recorded, "at the head of her retinue of white, lily-like ladies walked the Queen.
Her cheeks a sugar pink, her hair tightly curled around the Victorian diadem of precious stones perched straight on her brow. Her pink hands are folded meekly on the elaborate grandeur of her encrusted skirt. She is still a young girl with the demeanour of simplicity and humility. As she walks, she allows her heavy skirt to swing backwards and forwards in a beautiful rhythmic effect. This girlish figure has enormous dignity. She belongs in this scene of almost Byzantine magnificence."
The photographer had the master image he needed, the picture of Elizabeth at her crowning moment that his studio photographs would have to capture later at the palace. When the Abbey service ended just before 2 p.m, Beaton hurried back to his London base, his mother's home in Chelsea, to find Etty Beaton in place beside the wireless, listening to the BBC's commentary on the long procession of coaches around London that was just beginning. Grabbing a handful of aspirins, he managed to snatch an hour's sleep before dashing off, refreshed, to the palace. Inside the green drawing room, the backdrops, lights and technicians were all in place by the time the Gold State coach came bowling home through the central arch into the courtyard around 4:30. The Queen looked back over her shoulder and appeared somewhat dazed and exhausted, he noticed with anxiety. Cups of tea and fish-paste sandwiches seemed to work wonders. Not long after, girlish voices were heard at the end of the picture gallery. "Oh, hello, did you watch it? When did you get home?" From the mirror doors of the green drawing room, I spied the Queen with her ladies, her excited children. The family asking questions, jokes, smiles and laughter. The high-pitched voices of the Queen and Princess Margaret heard above the others. The Queen and the maids were heading for the throne room for the urgent press photographs to be taken and wired out around the world that very evening by the Times. Meanwhile, following the schedule drawn up by the palace's stern press secretary, Commander Richard Colville, Beaton began taking photographs of the other members of the family, starting with the Queen Mother, dimpled and chuckling, with her eyes as bright as any of her jewels. And Princess Margaret, in whose eyes the photographer detected a saucy sex twinkle of understanding. "No time to lose. Please turn this way. Now that." A certain shape was formed. A picture came to life. "Quick, quick." Beaton began to feel flustered. People were popping their heads in and out of the doors of the green drawing room. Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, then the Duke of Edinburgh. Prince Charles and Princess Anne seemed to be running amok, climbing up and around and under their Aunt Margaret's purple velvet train. Only the Queen Mother exuded calm, the great mother figure and nanny to us all, wrapping everyone, Beaton felt, in a warm counterpane of reassurance. Suddenly I had this wonderful accomplice, someone who would help me through everything. All at once, and because of her, I was enjoying my work. As the session got underway, Prince Charles and Princess Anne were still buzzing about with the wildest excitement. Their nannies were nowhere to be seen, and they would not keep still until the Queen Mother anchored them in her arms, put her head down to kiss Prince Charles's hair, and made a terrific picture. In just a few flashes, Beaton had snapped a set of informal and human images of the royal children he had never expected, plus a unique shot of the 3-year-old Princess Anne pacing out the long ermine run of her grandmother's train. Then, ashen-faced and like the wicked uncle in a pantomime, Richard Colville, who deals so sternly with all of us who are in any way connected with the press, appeared prematurely and, as if to sound my death knell, informed me, "The Queen has already been kept waiting. You must take the Queen now." The crucial moment had arrived. In came the Queen with her ladies, cool, smiling, sovereign of the situation. And Beaton asked his subject to start by posing alone in front of his blow-up backdrop of the Abbey fan vaulting, which, he had decided, would be reserved for his pictures of the Queen alone in her grandeur, holding orb and sceptre. The lighting was not at all as I would have wished, but no time for readjustments, every second of importance. He was working with an old-fashioned upright plate camera on a tripod, along with a Rolleiflex twin-lens reflex camera, which he kept hanging from a strap around his neck. As film needed replacing, Beaton reached behind him for a freshly charged camera from one of his assistants. "I was banging away and getting pictures at a great rate," he wrote, "but I had only the foggiest notion of whether I was taking black and white or colour or giving the right exposures." He also worried that his subject looked extremely minute under her robes and crown, her nose and hands chilled, and her eyes tired. "Yes," she told him in reply to his question, "the crown does get rather heavy." In the context of an entire reign, that was a quote for the history books, but for the moment, photography took precedence. Somehow, getting the Queen to pivot forward, then look up at him as he photographed her from above, Beaton coaxed her into one of her rare and dazzling full-face monkey smiles, with her astonishing array of teeth on display. A smiling Lilibet in black and white to partner the solemn and dignified sovereign he had shot in colour a few minutes earlier. No bags under the eyes, two photographs for the ages. Now to photograph the heroine's husband, who, in Beaton's view, was definitely adopting a rather ragging attitude towards the proceedings. The photographer felt on the back foot when it came to the Duke of Edinburgh, intimidated by his wry jokes, and his lips pursed in a smile that put the fear of God into me. I believe he doesn't like or approve of me. Perhaps he was disappointed that his friend Barham was not doing this job today. Lady Anne Cook, one of the maids of honour who knew about the rivalry with Barham, saw Beaton getting irritated by the way in which the Duke was obviously trying to take control, or perhaps even sabotage the proceedings, making suggestions about who should sit here and there, and she rather admired the courtesy with which the photographer finally snapped. "Cecil just stopped very politely and firmly," she recalled, "and asked, 'Would you like to take them, sir?' There was no more trouble from the Duke. Keeping the situation light, Beaton worked especially hard on a set of shots of Philip on his own, proudly recording in his diary that he had been able to make the Duke look extremely handsome in his naval uniform. "What shall we do now?" asked the Queen. "Will you go into the corner?" replied Beaton in a quick and cursory manner that he instantly regretted. "Go into the corner?" responded Elizabeth, her eyes wide open with surprise at his tone, but showing no offence. It was time for the final session of photographs of the six maids of honour grouped around their mistress, for which Patrick Matthews and the Vogue team had set up a sofa and lights in another corner of the room. "You must be tired, ma'am," Beaton asked. "Yes," she replied. "But this is the last thing we have to do." And with that she was off down the passage with Philip, the children, the maids and the rest of the family in her wake, all heading for the palace balcony again to watch the RAF fly past. Left alone in the suddenly deserted green drawing-room, Cecil and his sister Baba located a glass of champagne from which the Queen had been drinking and drained its contents together in a loyal toast, but with a sense of anticlimax. "I felt somewhat dissatisfied," confessed the diarist. "For better or worse, I'd had my chance. The sensation of achievement had escaped me all day long. Now I wondered if I had got any worthwhile pictures. Except with the Queen Mother and her grandchildren, I felt I'd never become airborne. The bulk of my pictures had been a smash-and-grab affair. I couldn't imagine they would be successful." Baba and Cecil went home together through the rain feeling utterly whacked, with a series of articles and interviews to complete for Australia and Canada on Cecil's impressions of the day. But at 3 in the morning, after some restorative food and drink at a French embassy party, Beaton rang his studio to discover that they were delighted with the colour pictures of the Queen, the main object of the exercise. And when he went in early that morning to see for himself, he was surprised that so many of the pictures were excellent. Posterity has endorsed that judgment. The surreal, almost Hollywood nature of Beaton's confected Abbey backdrops and studio lighting could have appeared artificial and even effete, as the Duke of Edinburgh and the Baron's School of Realism doubtless expected. But as the final pictures turned out, with the solid figure of the robed Queen with her regalia in the foreground and the conviction on her features both solemn and smiling, there was a transcendental glow to the images, Elizabeth's childhood haze of wonder, or, as another critic has described it, the strangely transfiguring radiance that encircles those who occupy a throne. Snapped in seconds, Cecil Beaton's smash-and-grab portraits of June 1953 stand comparison with weighty coronation paintings from past centuries that eminent artists laboured for months to compose. All that remained was to rush the prints and contact sheets to the palace to have a selection approved for publication, then to get the chosen shots out to the world. "The rest of the week was a complicated nightmare," wrote Beaton, "trying to supply to the press the requisite number of pictures. Messengers were waiting in the various rooms of my mother's house for another messenger who never arrived. I talked myself hoarse on the phone." Only by a fraction of a second did the exhausted photographer finally catch his train from Waterloo Station that Friday night to make his escape to the country. and as he settled back in his seat at the end of his busy week of achievement, there he saw it, publication for the first time. One of my pictures of the Queen was planted across the front page of the Evening News.
Chapter 6. Jelignite, The Princess and the Pilot. The magic of Elizabeth II's coronation was shattered with a speed that no one could have imagined, within minutes, in fact, of the new queen being crowned. As the royal entourage moved out of Westminster Abbey at the end of the historic ceremony of the 2nd of June 1953, Princess Margaret reached out playfully to brush a piece of fluff from the uniform of the handsome comptroller of her mother's recently formed household, RAF Group Captain Peter Townsend, DSO, DFC. The princess ran her white-gloved hand along the medals above the war hero's breast pocket with a flirtatiousness that caught the eye of a watching journalist. And with that gesture, the story of the new reign took a turn in a darker and more complicated direction.
"It didn't mean a thing to us at the time," Peter Townsend was to tell the journalist Jean Rooke many years later. "It must have been a bit of fur coat I picked up from some dowager in the Abbey. I never thought a thing about it."
But the press thought about it hard, and they drew their own conclusions.
"Picking fluff off a man's jacket, that's a gesture as intimate as a kiss," remarks Bill Matheson, the sardonic, muckraking reporter devised by series creator Peter Morgan to ignite the jelignite of royal scandal in episode 6 of The Crown.
"It's more intimate, since it suggests the kiss has already happened."
Princess Margaret first met Peter Townsend in February 1944, when she was 13 and wearing ankle socks, the very same age at which her elder sister had met and fallen in love with Philip. But whereas Lilibet's love affair with Philip developed over the years into a marriage that would provide a solid underpinning to the crown, Margaret's romance with a divorced man led in record time to the same controversy and scandal that had produced the unforgettable crisis of 1936.
"Historically, when this lot brush up against divorce," says Bill Matheson to his editor, "you end up with either reformation or abdication."
In 1944, the two teenage princesses had been lying in wait to catch a glimpse of an exciting new recruit to the royal household, and palace lore relates the 18-year-old Elizabeth's all-too-prophetic reaction.
"Bad luck. He's married."
Group Captain Townsend, 29 in February 1944, was arriving at the palace as a new sort of equerry, a battle hero who would serve and stand beside the king. An equerry was the male equivalent of a lady-in-waiting, and it had been George VI's idea in time of war to replace the conventionally upper-crust holder of the job with an equerry of honour, who had won the place by sheer valour, and who, frankly, deserved the cushiness of living for a spell in the company of the monarch. Townsend was a Battle of Britain fighter ace. He had led crack squadrons of Hurricanes and Spitfires in a brave and sparkling career that included downing 11 enemy planes, being shot down twice, and a brief period of mental strain and collapse, a nervous breakdown in the language of the time. He had the good looks of a film star and could deploy his delicate, slightly nervous charm in superabundance.
"He was like Jean-Louis Barrault,"
recalled the future master of the Queen's pictures, Sir Oliver Miller, referring to the dashing French actor of the time. "You expected him at any moment to leap up lightly onto the nearest chandelier." Townsend came from an honourable, empire-building background. Haileybury, his public school, had been founded to educate the sons of employees of the East India Company. In the 1940s, the school's most famous alumnus was Clement Attlee, the Labour Party leader who had acquired his social conscience when working in the progressive Haileybury mission that the school funded and ran in the East End of London. Townsend's grandfather was a general in the Indian Army, and his father was Deputy High Commissioner of Burma. Brought up among tiger skins and brass gongs, young Peter grew up with a strong sense of social service, with the tweaking of Eastern musings and mysticism. His decision to join the socially undistinguished RAF in the 1930s
was a form of rebellion.
At the time, he remembered, it was not at all the right place for a nice young man to go.
Townsend's tour of duty at the palace was originally supposed to be for just 3 months, but he stayed for nearly 10 years. King George VI, who shared both a stammer and a love for the RAF with his calm and capable young assistant, found Townsend's sensitivity a balm as he grew increasingly unwell. He treated Peter, as he soon became to all the family, as the son he never had, and the king's wife also came to lean on the new equerry. Peter had a rather lost quality that was both vague and glamorous, remembered Oliver Miller. It somehow fitted well with the Indian summer character of those last years of George VI. He was not quite connected to reality, and when that was linked with his extreme good looks and genuine friendliness, it turned out to make the situation unintentionally very dangerous indeed. The price of royal favour turned out to be the fighter ace's romantically hasty wartime marriage. His wife, Rosemary, became rapidly disenchanted with being left alone with two small children while her husband played cards and went to the opera with his grand adoptive family. After Princess Elizabeth married, Townsend was effectively co-opted as the elder sibling's replacement in the old Windsor family unit of Us Four, which now became Father, Mother, Margaret, and Peter.
There was a sense in which the King and Queen rather encouraged the closeness, remembered Philip's friend, Mike Parker.
To retain Townsend's services and congenial company, George VI eventually promoted the group captain from equerry to deputy master of the household, a uniquely demanding post. The job not only required supervision of the chauffeurs, valets, cooks and cleaners who started work in the palace at dawn, but Townsend was also expected to travel as a full-time Mr. Fix-It with the family, going everywhere, including Windsor, Sandringham and Balmoral, eating every meal at the royal table, and helping to organise the clan's beloved alfresco picnics. One modern holder of the post has calculated that these so-called holiday duties alone kept him away from his wife for 90 days and nights a year. This particular deputy master resigned after 5 years. In the old days, courtiers married women who took such separation for granted. Royal service was seen as a type of military posting. But neither Peter nor Rosemary Townsend rose to the challenge. One courtier remembers a birthday party for one of Townsend's sons at Adelaide Cottage, the Townsend's grace and favour residence at Windsor, once the country retreat of Queen Adelaide, the wife of King William IV. The telephone rang to ask if Peter would go riding with Princess Margaret, and though he was not on duty, he jumped to the call. Rosemary, for her part, looked for solace outside the marriage. When the couple divorced, she took the legal role of the guilty party, not contesting her own adultery with John de Laszlo, son of Philip de Laszlo, the society portrait painter, whom she married in a matter of months, her second of three marriages. The divorce came through shortly after the death of George VI, leaving Townsend needy and available precisely at the moment when Princess Margaret was also in personal distress.
After the king's death, there was an awful sense of being in a black hole.
The normally polished princess frankly confessed to the royal historian Ben Pimlott 40 years later. Often snootier than her elder sister, Margaret could also be more openly vulnerable, and it was in shared loss and pain that the princess and the war hero came together. The romance might have started as early as 1947, according to several sources, when Townsend and Margaret went riding together on the royal tour of South Africa, and it grew secretly from there. But it was not until the beginning of 1953, according to Townsend, a few months before the coronation, that matters came to a head, when the couple found themselves alone at Windsor Castle one day, with the rest of the family up in London.
"She listened without uttering a word," recalled Townsend in his memoir Time and Chance, "as I told her, very quietly, of my feelings. Then she simply said, 'That is exactly how I feel, too.'"
Margaret told her sister almost immediately, and the new queen's response was faintly encouraging, and certainly sisterly.
A few days later, remembered Townsend in his memoir, at Buckingham Palace, Her Majesty invited us both to spend the evening with her and Prince Philip.
There was a friendly equality about the two young couples, each sister with her dashing and handsome military partner, and Townsend later recalled an atmosphere of informal supportiveness. No one was minimizing the problems that lay ahead, with Philip making it his job to bring them up with the pointed banter that was becoming his trademark. Elizabeth herself was more opaque, and Townsend was impressed by her movingly simple and sympathetic acceptance of the disturbing fact of her sister's love for me. But as he sat with his feet under the royal table, the thought occurred to me that the Queen, behind all her warm goodwill, must have harboured not a little anxiety. In Gelignite, Peter Morgan imagines the conversation that the Queen and her husband might have had that night as they prepared for bed, Elizabeth trying hard to support her sister, with Philip pointing out the difficulties, starting with the parallels to Edward VIII.
Has everyone forgotten the catastrophe that was your uncle already?
The situation's different, replies Elizabeth defensively.
One party divorced, retorts Philip, the other royal. Sounds pretty similar to me.
While he also brushes aside Elizabeth's protest that Peter had been the blameless party in the divorce.
There is no such thing as a blameless party in a divorce, is his riposte.
Elizabeth's final argument tries to boost Townsend's comparative maturity, arguing that the elder man is a good influence on Margaret.
Is he? Replies Philip grimly. If he were really a good influence, he'd patch things up with his wife and leave Margaret well alone.
In real life, Tommy Lascelles dished out the same grim medicine to Peter Townsend's face.
You must be either mad or bad, declared the private secretary darkly,
making no attempt to feign sympathy when Townsend went to the veteran courtier for help. The group captain should be removed at once, Lascelles advised the Queen, and as far away as possible to some remote overseas posting. But as Margaret's only sister and her closest confidant, Elizabeth declined to be so hard-hearted. She agreed it was impossible for Townsend to stay in Clarence House, yet ignoring several backroom offices to which she could have dispatched him, she chose the post that brought him most visibly and frequently into contact with her. She made Townsend one of her own equerries. It was a sisterly and supportive gesture to Margaret, though with the coronation at this point just a few months away, it did not seem unreasonable for Elizabeth to ask the couple to keep everything private for the time being, and to wait to see how things might be worked out. Margaret's careless gesture on coronation day was a poor repayment for her elder sister's understanding, for it disastrously sabotaged the key element of the agreement, that the romance should, for the moment, remain a secret. There was a lot of fixing to accomplish behind the scenes, particularly with Downing Street, before there could be any prospect of the marriage Margaret longed for, and publicity would hurt people on all sides. Subconsciously or otherwise, Margaret's public act of possessiveness was the ultimate upstaging by the younger sister, who, as Elizabeth once complained to Crawfey, always wants what I have. Elizabeth II had got her crown on the 2nd of June 1953, but Princess Margaret had got her man, and as she left the scene of her sister's great triumph, she could not resist showing off her own talisman. A curious interlude ensued. American newspapers reported what came to be known as the Tender Hand incident next day, in line with the speculation they had been printing about the couple for some months. Following the pattern of the abdication crisis, the British press kept silent. But the self-restraint lasted less than 2 weeks, and when the dam broke on the 14th of June, it was with typical Fleet Street self-righteousness, with newspapers repeating the foreign rumours of Margaret's love for a divorced man. It is high time for the British public to be made aware, etc., etc., while suggesting that the rumours could not possibly be true. It is quite unthinkable, pronounced the people, that a royal princess, third in line to the throne, should even contemplate a marriage with a man who has been through the divorce courts. Group Captain Townsend was the innocent party, but his innocence cannot alter the fact that a marriage between Princess Margaret and himself would fly in the face of royal and Christian tradition. Down at Chartwell, his Kent country home, Winston Churchill's initial reaction was surprisingly favourable. "The course of true love must always be allowed to run smooth," declaimed the Prime Minister benevolently when Tommy Lascelles arrived for a council of war. Why shouldn't the beautiful young princess marry her handsome war hero? It took Clementine Churchill to remind her sentimental husband that he had made the very same mistake back in 1936, when his support for Edward VIII and Mrs. Simpson had proved so unpopular and politically damaging, and abdication parallels lay at the heart of the matter. For what purpose had the Duke of Windsor been made to suffer if his niece was now allowed to marry a divorced man? As in 1936, exile was the solution, though this time on a temporary basis. It was decided that Townsend would be dispatched as heir attaché to the British Embassy in Brussels to work as a mixture of spy and salesman, reporting back to London on Belgian aviation developments and sniffing out commercial opportunities for the British aircraft industry. Margaret, for her part, would have to delay her marriage decision until after August 1955, when she would become 25. She would then be outside the scope of the Royal Marriages Act of 1772, which required the assent of the Queen. In other words, of the Prime Minister and Cabinet, since this matter of public interest and debate was ultimately a political matter. Public opinion, at least as measured in the newspapers, seemed wholeheartedly in favour of the couple being allowed to marry. On the 13th of July 1953, the Daily Mirror cheekily printed a Princess Poll voting form on its front page that put the question in these terms. Group Captain Peter Townsend, 38 years old Battle of Britain pilot, was the innocent party in a divorce. He was given custody of his two children, and his former wife has recently remarried. If Princess Margaret, now 22, so desires, should she be allowed to marry him? No fewer than 70,000 readers took the trouble to fill in the form and post a reply, at the expense of a penny halfpenny per letter. A world record for a newspaper poll, according to the Mirror, with 67,907 voting in favour and only 2,235 against. The Press Council, the recently founded and voluntary body set up to organise the self-regulation of British journalism, promptly reprimanded the newspaper for its impertinence. There is some reason to doubt whether the self-selected 67,907 yes voters of the Daily Mirror were representative of a country that, in 1953, was still socially conservative and quite heavily influenced by traditional religious values. A newspaper poll that had inquired 2 years earlier whether young people should have sex before they married came up with a 52% vote for chastity for men and 63% for women. The reasons against premarital sex ranged from marriage should be a new experience to people wouldn't marry if they could get it without doing so. Church attendances were falling, but people still expected public figures and especially the royal family to set a good example. "Life, especially for those in high places, is not for self-satisfaction," wrote S.M.M. of Clapham Common to the Daily Mirror on the 20th of July 1953. "Renunciation by Princess Margaret will be a wonderful example and proof of the faith she professes in the Church of England." "The laws of the Church of England on divorce are quite definite," agreed P.F. Hall of Gerrard's Cross in the same correspondence column. "To suggest that a Christian should be allowed to break those laws to achieve her heart's desire is tantamount to suggesting that one may steal something just because one wants it." Winston Churchill knew how many of his Tory MPs would nod sagely at such opinions and decided, on reflection, there was no chance he could persuade his cabinet to give approval to a Margaret Townsend marriage in 1953, even though there were divorcees among his ministers, starting with his number two, Anthony Eden, who had recently remarried, this time to Churchill's own niece, Clarissa. Margaret would have to delay her gratification for another 2 years, and that posed something of a challenge to a young woman who was accustomed to getting her own way. "I am unique," Princess Margaret was given to pronouncing over dinner, apropos of nothing in particular. "I am the daughter of a king and the sister of a queen." The derivative nature of this conversation stopper summed up the unhappiness of the queen's younger sister, who spent her life struggling to establish a satisfying identity of her own. A birthright of incredible privilege that could have been a platform for constructive endeavour was never quite fulfilled, leaving the princess with the perpetual grievance of the also-ran, to which a succession of backstairs anecdotes bore witness. In 1937, for example, while trying on their robes for their father's coronation, the 6-year-old Margaret was said to have thrown a fit when she discovered that the purple velvet train edged with ermine behind her ceremonial outfit was cut slightly shorter than that of her elder sister. It wasn't fair, she complained, and she flung herself to the floor in a tantrum. Only when it was explained to her that the two sisters' trains had been designed in direct proportion to their height, and that Lilibet was nearly 4 inches taller, was the princess placated, and then only grudgingly so. "What a good thing," courtiers would murmur, "that Margaret is the younger one." In adult life, according to Lord Snowden's biographer Anne de Courcy, Margaret's inferiority complex showed itself in her lack of consideration towards the staff that she shared with her mother in Clarence House. If there was a Christmas party down the road at Buckingham Palace to which the staff of Clarence House were invited, the Queen Mother would arrange to dine out that evening, or eat something light so that her servants could get to the party, while Princess Margaret, to the contrary, would make a point of arranging a full-scale dinner party for that very night. Such perversity, suggested de Courcy, could perhaps be explained by the fact that, unlike the Queen Mother and the Queen, who had successively been the first lady in the land, Princess Margaret, always number two, was determined to insist on her royal status. Kenneth Rose, the royal confidant and biographer of King George V, used to attempt a brave defence of the princess's sometimes contrary behaviour. "We show no lack of sympathy," he once declared, "for those who are denied an inspiring education for social reasons like poverty or colour. But there are shortcomings at both ends of the social scale. The two princesses, Elizabeth and Margaret Rose, were not educated in a rigorous or testing fashion. They never experienced the challenge of going to school, and that certainly left an unsatisfied appetite in the younger of the two sisters." From private conversations with the princess, Rose learned how bitterly she resented not being allowed to accompany her elder sister, or even to follow her at a later age, when Elizabeth was sent for constitutional history lessons at Eton College with the vice provost, Henry Martin, in the early 1940s. At that stage in their lives, after all, Margaret was next in the line of succession. Her grandmother, Queen Mary, also worried about the deficiencies of both girls' homeschooling. "Queen Mary tried to beef up the princess's lessons," recalled Rose, "but Queen Elizabeth didn't think education for women necessary." Rose related how the former Princess May of Teck, herself extremely cultured and well-versed in the fine arts, took up the matter with her daughter-in-law, Queen Elizabeth, only for her plea to fall on stony ground. "I don't know what she's complaining about," the home-schooled Queen Elizabeth later said to her friends. "My sisters and I were all educated at home by a governess, and we all married very well. In fact, you might say that one of us married very well indeed." To Margaret's credit, she did make valiant efforts to educate herself, particularly in the artistic subjects that fired her imagination: history, art, architecture, dance, music, and theatre. She seems to have been the origin of the famous wartime Windsor pantomimes that grew out of a modest nativity play that the princesses performed with child evacuees during the second Christmas of the war in December 1940. Margaret sang "Gentle Jesus, Meek and Mild" so effectingly in the nativity play that her father was moved to tears. "I wept,"
through most of it, wrote the king in his diary. And when Marion Crawford suggested that the girls might attempt something more ambitious the following year, the younger Margaret leapt at the idea. From that moment, the governess later wrote, I had no peace. Margaret was after me incessantly. Crawfy, you did say, she would begin a dozen times a week. The 10-year-old was so keen, she started designing costumes and sets, pushing her father until he gave permission for the ambitious series of pantomime productions that became the highlight of Windsor Christmases during the war. She also worked seriously at her own mastery of music, and of the piano in particular. Princess Margaret Rose, she dropped the rose soon after she became a teenager, made a point of growing up more rapidly than her elder sister, delightedly abandoning the velvet-collared coats and ankle socks of childhood. She was not yet 14 when she made her first public speech in July 1944, visiting the Princess Margaret Royal Free School in Windsor, named in her honour. Accompanied by her mother, she felt dreadfully sick with nerves and did not enjoy the experience. But she fared better 2 years later on her first solo engagement, when she opened the Hopscotch Inn, a children's play centre in Camden, North London. One has to remember that she was only 15 at the time, recalled Audrey Russell, sent by the BBC to cover the event in March 1946. But I was first struck by her marvellous poise. I think she was trying very hard to follow her mother's example, talking to everybody and asking questions all the time, which she did very professionally. By the time she was 16, Princess Margaret had that poise in abundance, stylishly dressing in tailored suits, designer hats, silk stockings and high heels, with long dresses of silk, satin or chiffon for evenings. Her father had organized her own coat of arms to be followed by a specially created cipher for her personal use, a classically styled M beneath a coronet embossed in red on her private stationery. "Let us pray for Princess Margaret," pronounced the chaplain at Crathy Church, Balmoral, when she celebrated her 18th birthday in August 1948, "that God may bless and prosper her in such purposes as she has in her heart." With Elizabeth's love and marriage an old story, the press now turned their attentions towards the sophisticated younger sister, her complexion smooth as a peach, her curvaceous figure and 18-inch waist, with her vivid blue eyes. "The only thing about me worth looking at," she once said. Reporters suggestively described her lips as both generous and sensitive, for while it was not done to say as much in so many words, sex appeal was the fresh ingredient that Princess Margaret brought to the royal package. She was talked of as one of the beauties of her generation. She did prefer her friends to curtsy and to call her ma'am, but after a few gin and tonics, she was the life and soul of every party. Noel Coward was impressed when he encountered her in November 1949 at a private dinner party at the American Embassy. "Princess Margaret obliged with songs at the piano," noted the master in his diary. "Surprisingly good. She has an impeccable ear. Her piano playing is simple but has perfect rhythm, and her method of singing is really very funny." Invited to entertain a Scottish cleric who came to tea with her parents, Margaret launched into a spirited rendering of I'm Just a Girl Who Can't Say No from the Rodgers and Hammerstein hip musical Oklahoma, to the horror of her mother and the delight of her father, whose roar of regal laughter made it clear to the minister that he was expected to laugh as well. Espiègle, roguish, was Queen Mary's word for her granddaughter's sense of mischief, a corruption of the French name for Till Eulenspiegel, the peasant prankster of German folklore. "She is so outrageously amusing," remarked the Queen, "that one can't help encouraging her." "Elizabeth is my pride," said George VI on one telling occasion, "and Margaret is my joy." The King had egged on his irreverent younger daughter, a natural mimic, to indulge her cheekiness from an early age, and in this glow of parental approval, Margaret had developed a more extrovert personality than Elizabeth, less solemn,
less conscientious, and altogether less well-mannered. This was the nub of the problem. Princess Margaret was, quite simply, spoilt. Her elders indulged her because she was amusing, but also because they felt she was owed something. Some correction or compensation for her junior role in the royal setup, with Princess Elizabeth feeling most guilty of all. A cook from the York's home at 145 Piccadilly in the mid-1930s recalled how the elder sister would go out of her way to spare Margaret the more arduous duties of the girl's compulsory housework by taking them on herself. Conscious of her own seniority and advantages, the elder sibling seems to have bent over backwards to be nice to Margaret in the family tradition, when it might actually have benefited Margaret to have a nasty elder sister who put her in her place from time to time. "We are only young once, Crawfy," her mother told Marion Crawford when the governess, still on the family payroll in the late 1940s, expressed her concerns that Margaret was all over the place after a succession of late nights out. "We want her to have a good time. With Lilibet gone, it is lonely for her here." So Margaret took to lolling in bed of a morning. 10 or 10:30 came to be her routine breakfast time for the rest of her life, after long nights out with a group of young people that the newspapers took to calling the Princess Margaret set, all of them high-spirited and of independent means, with none of them needing to start their day early. Old Etonian Billy Wallace, Colin Tennant, the future Lord Glenconner, Sonny Blandford, the future Duke of Marlborough, and American Sharman Douglas, the ebullient daughter of Lewis Douglas, Harry Truman's ambassador to the Court of St. James. "Princess Margaret high kicks it," ran the headline over one description of a ball at the American Embassy, where the princess and Jennifer Bevan, her first lady-in-waiting, danced a well-rehearsed can-can with Sharman Douglas and three other girlfriends, all dressed in authentic frilly petticoats, black fishnet stockings, and feather bonnets. "Princess Margaret is great news value," wrote Cecil Beaton in his diary when he took the photographs for her 21st birthday in 1951. "She has grown up, an independent character showing more signs of interest in unconventional life than any member of the royal family since Edward, Prince of Wales." A few years earlier, Duff Cooper, the former British ambassador to Paris, had put it even more directly after a Buckingham Palace luncheon party at which Margaret had shone in 1948. "Lovely skin, lovely eyes, lovely mouth, very sure of herself and full of humour. She might get into trouble before she's finished." Neither Beaton nor Cooper knew about Peter Townsend when they made their prophetic diary entries, but by at least one account, Princess Margaret had made up her mind about him the previous year, during the February-April 1947 royal tour of South Africa. "We rode together every morning in that wonderful country in marvellous weather," the princess told a confidant. "That's when I really fell in love with him." It was also, presumably, when she fell out of love with being royal, since renunciation was the only possible price of the man she had come to desire.